Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome all to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining me in the second chair tonight is, well, let's just say he's the man. Editor at American Thinker, J.R. Dunn. Say hello to the people, J.R.
Hello, people. And this here is the power... The power section of the Rhino Hour of Power.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Absolutely. A little bit later, we'll have Patrick Poole, who is the terrorism and national security correspondent for PJ Media. He writes all over the place. He writes at Breitbart. He writes at. He just had a piece published in the Washington Post. He's really knows his stuff. And we're going to pick his brain on a subject that we all think we know a lot about, but probably don't. And that is global terrorism, the networks, the connections, the myths, and the reality.
Not enough. And, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Not
I think
enough.
That's more apt. That's true. So we're going to have Patrick on, and we're going to pick his brain for 45 minutes or so. In the meantime, JR. We have to talk about this because it is the most puzzling event of the Obama administration, to my mind. Now, for some who think they know all about Obama, it isn't. It isn't. But 3 million people turn out in the streets of Paris. 44 world leaders, most of them presidents and premiers of their countries, show up at a rally in Paris. And the highest-ranking American official is former Obama bundler, the passenger to France.
Well put.
I mean, you can't say that with a straight face, can you? I mean, that's just unreal.
No.
His choices for ambassador, they're political plums that go to big donors.
Right.
We all know
right.
that.
But
every
this
president.
As is always the case with Obama, it's absolutely blatant beyond the conceivable horizon. Just total blatancy. He just doesn't care what anybody thinks about his choices.
Well, he picks people who've never been to the country, who don't know the language, who don't know anything about it. I mean, it's like you give $1 million to Obama, you get to go to Brussels
that's
or
it.
Something. Jeez.
That's it.
Oh,
he doesn't care. He does. He just could not give two flips.
Well, he doesn't.
And that is the story
behind this.
What's that?
The only people who call him out on it are conservatives. The liberals
and
won't call him out.
Nobody else pays any attention.
Nobody in this
media.
It's just ridiculous.
Well, you know, he's God, so I guess he can do whatever he wants.
Yeah,
that's the only thing I can think of.
Obama doesn't show up, and Josh Ernst, the press secretary for the White House, had an interesting journey, if you will, from Sunday afternoon until Monday afternoon, where he changed the narrative of why the president didn't go to Paris about five times. I mean, first it was mm-hmm. It's not about us. That was their big thing on Sunday. Well, the terrorism is not about us. It's about
there
the world.
There was a parade?
Yeah, that was right. And then John Kerry weighed in. John Kerry weighed in. Well, we sent 3 high-ranking officials. Well, Eric Holder didn't even join the march. He left before the march started.
That's the killer of the whole thing. Eric Holder was in Paris. He was about half a mile away, and he couldn't be bothered to stroll over there. That's what the French would call the lagniappe. That is the icing on the cake, right there.
Yes. and the Undersecretary of State for something was there too. So, wow, impressive. At any rate,
for poodle grooming,
the Europeans are far too polite to complain, especially the French, who are, after all, they invented politeness, they invented manners. So they haven't really said that much. One cheeky newspaper in Great Britain, I think it was the Daily Mail, headlined it. But BBC didn't touch it. None of the European big, like AFP or agents or whatever, they, none of the European wire services touched the story. And in America, it did resonate. I mean, you even had liberals all over the map, taking Obama to task for not going. But
that's right. I read a selection of them today. Jake Tapper, several of the other, several of the female liberal talk show hosts that all look alike and have they're all named Tiffany or Heather or something like this. They're all complaining about it, which is kind of amazing, really.
Well, Tapper even said he was ashamed.
Yeah,
Tapper said on air
he
was ashamed. Yeah.
That's not really surprising coming from Tapper because he does speak his mind. But these other ones, these other creatures that the everyday run of the mill Obama worshippers, the ones who carry candles in his procession, they're criticizing him, which is kind of amazing. But it just shows you how far it's hit. But of course, nobody's come up with a reason yet, and the reason is he doesn't give a damn anymore. He's a lame duck, and he doesn't have to keep up appearances anymore. And to hell with Charlie Hebdo, to hell with the Europeans, to hell with everybody. He's going to sit around and he's going to watch the sports.
And notice that the staff anesthetized him by saying, "Oh well, we didn't even talk to him about it. It was a staff decision." Whenever something goes wrong in that administration, he doesn't know. He doesn't know anything. He knows nothing.
Of course, that goes way back. But I like the excuse that the Secret Service could not possibly have cleared that situation to allow him to go there in safety. Now, you recall back in 1970, when the country really seemed to be on the verge of revolution, Richard Nixon left the White House and walked around in the middle of the night, talking to the demonstrators, try to find out what was on their mind. And, nobody cleared that situation. If Richard Nixon, as totally despised as he was in 1970, could walk out and do that in the face of people who absolutely hated his guts, the weathermen, the SDS, and so forth, I think that Obama could have hopped on a plane. And it's also a slap in the face of the French, too. Because you're saying the French could not secure that route for the 15 minutes it would take Obama to come in, do his photo op, and then race to a hotel with cable so he could watch the end of the game. Come on,
Netanyahu was there. Netanyahu was there.
Yes,
the Israeli Prime Minister marched
2 feet away
right
from Mahmoud Abbas.
Yeah. Which was a joke, of course, an anti-terror rally featuring the chairman of the PLO.
Yeah.
That's great.
Absolutely. Now that would have been a good excuse for Obama. He didn't want to march with Mahmoud Abbas. That would have been a great excuse. That probably would have gone a lot farther than the song and dance that they've been going through for the last 3 days. Think about
it. Okay, so you mentioned briefly the reason Obama didn't go is that he doesn't care. Why is it a little deeper than that?
He doesn't care anymore.
I'm sure you have – it's got to be deeper than that. Roger Simon.
I think that's about as deep as he goes, Rick. I don't think he goes much deeper. People talk about him being a narcissist and not really giving a damn about anybody else on the face of the earth. I think there's a lot of truth in that, and I think that looking for deeper motives in Obama beyond what matters to him is really kind of waste effort. You know what I mean?
Well, I think you're right, but it's not only does it matter to him, the march, but terrorism doesn't matter to him. In fact, he spent 6 years downplaying terrorism, which is why he didn't want to go to war. Yeah, he played 6 years downplaying the idea that they don't call terrorists, they call them violent extremists.
Yeah, violent extremists, and what is it? This is the era of global dysfunction, or whatever the hell he came up with for the war on terror, the global disaster, or some damn fool thing.
And
the only time he cared about terrorism was when he could take credit for knocking off Osama. That's the only time he ever cared. Because it meant something to him personally. That's something he could benefit from it, okay? And that's when he cared about terrorism.
He doesn't see terrorism as a threat. He doesn't see anything a threat. He just sees it as an impediment to his desire to transform the domestic politics and policy of America.
That's true.
I think that's basically why he didn't go. And plus, he wants to repair our relations with the Muslim world, so he reaches out to Iran, and he reaches out to Turkey, and he reaches out to the Muslim Brotherhood. Wait a minute. Okay,
I think you hit on something right there, too. It's his desire to transform the United States. As it stands, that's not going to happen. He really worked his butt off of that for 4 years. Obamacare and this, that, and another thing. And it's not happening. He throws in these things, and either the country adjusts or else they get torn up and tossed in the trash, as is going to happen to Obamacare over the next couple of months. And, bringing in his half-assed amnesty, et cetera, and so forth. From this point on, no matter what he does, he's not going to transform the United States. The U.S. is not going to turn into his goofball idea of a socialist paradise. And I think he really resents that. And I think adds to this kind of thing. If he can't change the country, if he can't be the black FDR, he's not going to do anything.
Yeah, and it's still, you have to wonder, if he wasn't informed by the staff, but didn't he turn on the news Sunday morning and watch, or even Saturday and get a sense of all these world issues that were going to be showing up?
Of course, he must have had some idea. Now, it's granted, any president lives in a bubble, and he has to depend on what his staff tells him. But you talk about this, and it's presidents have this sixth sense where they can look at a situation and figure out, I have to do this. X happened. I have to do Y and Z in order to make an impact, in order to utilize the situation. And people for years have been saying, oh, well, Obama's the master of this, and he's the master of that. If the aliens came, we'd send Obama because he'd know exactly what to do. And, there's no evidence of this. And this is the absolute proof. Now, consider Bush in New York. Bush went to New York, and he gave probably the finest impromptu statement of his entire presidency, which was, I hear you, and the world is going to hear you.
Yeah.
He knew exactly what to say. Obama does not. Obama comes out with some lame half-wit thing, and this is the ultimate kind of outcome of this. Now he can't even be bothered to do that. He can't be bothered to come out with some half-wit statement. He's just going to sit there and watch the bowl games.
Yeah. I just flabbergasted me when I
heard
on Saturday. And it not only that, but I think Tapper expressed it correctly. It made you ashamed. To be in America.
The United States.
And I'm trying to think of put another president, any other president of the post World War II era in that position. Any other president. And they all would have gone.
Absolutely.
Rattle
it doesn't come up.
Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton, Bush 2, they all would have gone.
Look at FDR, a dying man, crippled in a wheelchair, and he goes halfway around the world, not once, but a half a dozen times to conferences in World War II.
Yes.
And he was sick. He was sick, and
he was
going out,
Yalta.
And he knew it. But absolutely, you can tell by the pictures there. He was a dying man, but he went anyway. Why? Because it was necessary. And this supposedly is one of is one of Bambi's idols. I mean, come on.
No kidding. He's as far from Truman as far from FDR.
FDR, any of them. They all just stand gigantic over him. There's no question. Even the poor presidents. I mean, as the joke goes, Jimmy Carter is thanking God for Obama.
Yeah, right. Finally, I'm not the worst president since World War II.
That's it. That's it right there.
Yeah. Well, it was very curious, the development of the narrative over 24 hours, until they finally got around to saying, yeah, we probably should have sent somebody a little higher up.
Probably should have, yeah.
Like maybe, you know, John Kerry, well, he was in India at some entrepreneurial conference. I mean, holy cow, he couldn't have dropped everything and flown. I mean, he's got an airplane. Could have flown to France. Of course, he speaks French fluently.
Right.
They'd love him, you know?
Yeah. But Holder could have walked over there, you know, and nobody even thinks of it. It just never occurred to him. This shows you how completely stupid and empty-headed the entire administration is. It's not just Obama. Obama is any administration is a reflection of the chief, and that's what you got here. You got people who are completely tone deaf, truly stupid, truly uninformed, and who just don't give a damn anymore.
Yeah.
And depending on how you look at it, that's either a good sign for the next 2 years or that's a bad sign. I think it's kind of a mix myself. I'm just looking forward to seeing what happens.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing him gone. Okay, let's bring on our guest for this evening.
Okay.
Patrick Poole is the terrorism and national security correspondent for PJ Media. He writes all over the world, all over the globe, all over the media, Breitbart, Frank Gaffney's outfit, whose name escapes me, at the Center for Security Studies, I think. Anyway, welcome, Patrick. Hang on. Oh, got to get you on the line here. Hang on.
How you doing, guys?
Hi.
You're on. Oh, good. Hi, Patrick.
How you doing?
Thanks for joining us tonight. You're on with J.R. Dunn of American Thinker.
How are you?
Which I'm sure you – speaking of places you write for, American Thinker is another one. I wanted to get this discussion started, Patrick, reviewing recent events, France, and a little noted, in fact, you broke the story. You might have broken the story the day after the Paris attacks of the 2,000 innocents murdered, massacred by Boko Haram in Nigeria. You actually broke that story because at the time people were saying a couple of dozen people were killed. And then go ahead.
I broke the story on Thursday, a full day ahead of the establishment media and the initial reports. Particularly, I was even looking at the Reuters report that came out the day after I broke the story, where they were saying that there were dozens. Well, you know, now there's pretty much consensus, including Human Rights Watch, that, you know, nearly 2,000 were massacred in the attack on Baga and the surrounding villages there in Borno State by Boko Haram. Of course, the problem is that the in Nigeria right now, they are currently going through their presidential campaign. Their election, presidential election, is February 14th, and President Goodluck Jonathan is, I think, rightly come under fire for his complete mishandling of the Boko Haram threat, and his government has a vested interest in downplaying the extent of casualties. Of course, that was the last government holdout in Borno State, which has basically come under complete control of Boko Haram. In fact, Boko Haram now controls an area the size of Belgium, for comparisons. And 2,000 people is the only attack in recent memory that compares to that is, of course, the 9/11 attack.
Yes. Yes.
And compare it to the population in the United States, it's more like 20 or 30,000.
Yeah.
They have about 170 million, so it's about half of the United States.
Okay,
you know, so, yeah,
okay, but it's a much bigger disaster by ratio.
You know, and so 2,000 lives lost, and at this point, really no prospect of the Nigerian government being able to roll back. In fact, just here within the past 2-3 days, Boko Haram has been launching attacks in Cameroon against their military there. And it's we're seeing these Islamist militias all across Africa. You know, of course, you've got the Al-Shabaab problem in Somalia and Kenya and even Uganda now. You had the Muslim Salika rebels take over the Central African Republic here about two and a half years ago, and they began waging religious cleansing in Central African Republic. The French intervened and pushed the Salika out. Now, of course, the Christians are like, okay, well, you know, we're not going to tolerate this anymore, and began their own campaign to wipe out the Muslims.
Turn about
the country.
Yeah.
And, you know, now we're seeing these Islamist militias conducting attacks in Congo. But my, as I mentioned in my article at PJ Media last month on the 8 terrifying trends going on in Nigeria, is that country is the most populous country in Africa. It is also the richest because of its oil industry. Of course, that doesn't necessarily translate into, you know, cash in the pockets of your average Nigerian, but it has the highest GDP in the continent of Africa. So it's really the key. If we lose Nigeria, we'll lose the continent of Africa. And many of, well, I'm not even going to qualify it. Virtually all these Islamist militias are being fueled by the weapons that they got from Libya when the Obama administation joined with the French and the British to knock off Gaddafi. When
yeah,
Libya
is just the
Gaddafi,
gift that keeps giving.
Yeah, and, you know, I was seeing the one of the EU ministers said today, said, you know, we can't afford to not be involved in Libya because Libya is going to be involved with us, you know, meaning, you
right.
know, terrorism spreading and metastasizing into Europe from Libya. And, of course, you know, last week we saw, you know, it looks like these guys, the cell was connected to AQAP in Yemen. So, I mean, it's bad. And, I mean, it's getting worse. And, you know, you see the... You know, the happy clappy stuff that General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, was saying over the weekend that, well, you know, ISIS is going to collapse in on itself. Well, hey, you know, ISIS, which is nothing more than Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi's old group. You know, remember, most
right.
of the ISIS leadership was in prison, was, you know, was being detained by the United States government in Iraq.
Get
and
out,
we released
yeah.
them all. And, you know, they survived 8 years of American occupation of Iraq. And, you know, here they are, you know, with control of a large swath of northern Syria and about a third of Iraq. And, you know, as I've been reporting at, again, at PJ Media, is that they are very close to surrounding the western parts around Baghdad. They've even been able to land mortar shells inside the U.S. Embassy compound, the largest embassy in the world. And it's bad. They nearly took over the Baghdad airport here. I guess it was about 6 weeks ago. They made a run on Baghdad International Airport. And they were only repulsed by a counterattack by 2 Apache helicopters. But we're going to see them continue. And we've now got thousands of people, Americans, in Iraq. We've got 3,000 military personnel, 700 of which Obama just sent over to protect the embassy. We've got advisors fighting with these Shiite, Iranian-backed Shiite militias. And
yeah.
I mean, it's a hydra. You know, you cut off one head and 10 more spring up.
Yeah. If Obama had actually planned this, If he'd actually planned this, it couldn't be worse.
Yeah, well, and we also have to throw Hillary Clinton's name in here too.
True, absolutely.
You know, this was the decision to intervene in Libya and knock off Gaddafi.
I was just thinking, good intentions coming home. That's the process here.
Well, and for all of his faults and for all of his human rights abuses, the one good thing that Gaddafi did was he was killing Al Qaeda.
And that's why they
needed to knock him off.
He kept that whole mess together. It's very much like Tito in Yugoslavia.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's an extremely tribal society, and so we see this Libyan national army under Haftar, you know, fighting Ansar al-Sharia, and, you know, the Libya Dawn, which is basically the Muslim Brotherhood, partnering with Ansar al-Sharia. Remember, these are the guys, you know, Muslim Brotherhood are the guys who are going to help us defeat al-Qaeda, you know, and in Libya we see an active, open cooperation between al-Qaeda and the Brotherhood. And, of course, we see them doing the same thing in Syria. But Hillary, Samantha Powers, and Susan Rice were the three cheerleaders.
That's real.
To overthrow Gaddafi. Well, here we are. And honestly, I think that Hillary's signature failure is going to be Nigeria. It will be the most catastrophic decision. Her entire tenure at State Department, she refused to designate Boko Haram a terrorist organization. That only happened just over a year ago, and again, that was under Kerry. And in fact, that decision to not designate was at the same time that the Justice Department was urging, and this was reported by Reuters at the time, the Justice Department was urging the State Department under Hillary to designate them, and for a year and a half, they refused.
Right.
And here we are. And, you know, that was back, you know, in 2012 where, you know, Al-Qaeda is decimated and on the run, and, you know, there's no terrorism to see here. Ignore the man behind the curtain.
Well, we'll just send him a reset button, and it'll take care of that.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Africa. Let's go back to Africa, Patrick, because as you mentioned, it's very, very, very important in Nigeria, especially the massacre in Borno province. The approximate target was a military compound of a coalition, I guess, of what is it, Niger, Cameroon, and one other country. Chad, thank you. They've sent troops. I don't know how many, but they attacked this compound and they fled. Now, why the massacre? Were these people Catholics or Christians? Or
they were in the area and
they were around.
The military. There were actually two separate attacks. They launched the attack on the military, and the military's fled. In fact, the including the Nigerian military fled. That was the first.
I have a question for you on that. Now, much of the Nigerian military officer case is Hausa, who tend to be Muslim. Could that be a problem here?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's part of the dilemma in Nigeria is that you have these Nigerian emirs in northern Nigeria who are Muslim, and it's the Sultan of Sokoto is the de facto leader, and the Sultan of Sokoto is much like our ally Pakistan or our ally Saudi Arabia, has played this double game where, you know, to the Western media, he condemns Boko Haram, but there's clear evidence that he had been supporting Boko Haram.
Okay.
And, you know, and these, you have tribal allegiances, and, you know, I've got colleagues who are on the ground in Nigeria, it's a rapidly changing, shifting scenario, and of course, the CIA has virtually no assets anywhere. I mean, we have absolutely no idea what's going on. We are completely blind to what's going on because of how the human intelligence, which is basically the CIA's wheelhouse. I mean, it's, as one former agency contact I have said, you know, the CIA doesn't know how to do intelligence anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they mm-hmm. don't know how to get assets, and you have a bunch of analysts, you know, who sit, you know, at their desk at Langley or, you know, in these CIA stations, and you've got this active collusion between the embassies and the CIA, and you know, they end up passing up what the administration wants to hear.
Right.
And Nigeria is a perfect example of this problem, where this the embassy there was the leading force to prevent the designation of Boko Haram, and
okay.
they were making the argument that, well, you know, if you designate Boko Haram, then they'll start acting like terrorists. And I mean, it's just, you know, it's kind of fourth grade thinking, but I mean, it's the fourth grade thinking that predominates the foreign policy schools at Harvard and Georgetown. And,
oh, it's very commonplace. This is the same thing happened in the 30s with the Nazis.
Yeah. So and the kicker with the U.S. embassy in Nigeria is that you have a bunch of former State Department employees from the embassy there in Abuja that are now in positions and appointed to positions by the Sultan of Sokoto. You know, the top funder of Boko Haram. I mean, that's kind of an open secret that, you know, you have these former State Department people who are sitting on boards and stuff like that, but they basically owe their paycheck to the Sultan of Sokoto, and that complicates things. You know, now we're seeing here today the reports emerging, and I've heard it from my contacts in the field. You know, I didn't say anything about it because, you know, I was kind of sworn to secrecy, but now we see the reports coming out today. I saw Vice News and the Associated Press came out that it looks like the Chibok schoolgirls who were abducted back in April are the ones who are being forced to carry out the suicide bombings. Such as the one we saw here the other day, you know, where, you know, the other day you had a 10-year-old girl and on the ground have verified that in fact is what's happening. It's just an apocalyptic scenario of what's mm-hmm. happening in Nigeria, and it's not much different from, you know, what's happening in Syria and Iraq. Is not much different. I mean, things are so bad in Iraq, we are partnering with Iran, who the United States still identifies as the leading state sponsor of terrorism in the world. And we're partnering with them because the Shiite militias, the same Shiite militias who were responsible for killing more American soldiers in Iraq than Al-Qaeda ever did, and they're now our partners. And of course, you know, we were against Assad. You know, we wanted to overthrow Assad, so we backed these quote unquote vetted moderates. And of course, you know, from the beginning of that project, I just said, you know, and I said publicly in my writings that you know, this is nonsense. And of course, you had Muslim Brotherhood figures from the United States. Who are now the top officials running the Syrian National Council, guys like Louis Safi, and you had Barack Obama's former campaign Muslim advisor, Mazen Izbahi, who was running this Syrian charity that was basically funneling all the money and weapons to the quote-unquote vetted moderates. That thing's collapsed now that the administration has flipped their position, and now we're having to back Assad. I'm old enough to remember back in 2008, 2009, where Hillary Clinton and Nancy Pelosi and John Kerry were saying that Assad was the moderate.
Right.
And there's the picture of John and Teresa Kerry having dinner with Assad and his wife in Damascus.
That's right. That's right. I remember that one.
And, Hillary making the statement that Assad's a moderate, and, you know, several 2011 rolls around, the so-called Arab Spring, and, now Assad has to go, you know, and so we pump money and weapons into Syria. We now have 200,000 dead Syrians, and now we're back to where we started. You know, we got to back Assad. So it's you look at who we've got running the National Security Council, you know, former Obama campaign drivers, kids
Ben
who,
Rhodes,
you know,
yeah.
are children of wealthy Obama donors, and there are no adults in the room. And if you've seen this Ben Rhodes clown, the Deputy National Security Advisor, I mean, this guy's a blazing idiot who has absolutely no idea what he's talking about most of the time. Of course, his brother is the head of CBS News.
Yes. Right.
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah. Can we get back to, well, at least start a conversation about the networking that goes on, especially among these African terror groups? Al-Shabaab, for instance, I recall reading last summer, might have been you, even you mentioning it, Al-Shabaab has made a formal or informal alliance with Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. And that's what makes them particularly dangerous to us, because as we saw in Paris, AQAP is now apparently able and willing, certainly, to carry out global terrorist operations, mm-hmm. Fund them, train the guys to do it, and send them on their way.
AQAP was behind the attempted underwear bombing of the Northwest Airlines flight on Christmas Day here back in
Detroit. Yeah,
I think it was December 2009.
So what is the relationship, for instance, between Boko Haram and some of these other terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab, that group in Somalia, besides Al-Shabaab, there are several, the Mali terrorists. Are these people all connected? Is there really some kind of global conspiracy, or is that actually a myth?
Well, I wouldn't call it a conspiracy, but certainly there is a network. I mean, in many of these guys in Africa, leaders at least, fought with Al-Shabaab. You know, that was the hot spot, and that's where a lot of these guys got their training. That said, the other place they got their training was from the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 2003, President Bush launched what's called the Pan-Sahel Initiative, Counterterrorism Initiative, and The Economist actually reported on this here about a year and a half ago, where it was, you know, the U.S.'s terror boomerang, I think was the title of the article, and it talked about that most of these rebels in North Africa, you know, that were involved in Mali before the French arrived, and of course we've seen stuff happening in Mali here just within the past week. Most of those officers were trained by the United States, under the Panzahail counterterrorism initiative. And after the overthrow of Gaddafi, and you had this massive flood of weapons, there are weapons turning up in Gaza. There were weapons from Libya that have turned up in Syria. I mean, and they're fueling these insurgencies in Africa, whether it's Al-Shabaab, Salika, the Janjaweed in Sudan, who are, you know, still killing people in Darfur. I mean, it's amazing the attention span of these Hollywood stars and their causes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you haven't heard any of them blather on about Darfur, but I mean, they're still, killing black Africans in Darfur. You've got Boko Haram, you have Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, which is basically North Africa. We had the attack on the oil facility where the Americans were killed last year. You have Ansar Beit al-Maqdis operating in the Sinai. You know, I spent a month in Egypt here last year and was met with a number of their security officials. And, I mean, they have all they can handle with Ansar Beit al-Maqdis. We saw all the rocket attacks from Hamas over the summer. As you said earlier, there's you couldn't plan a more horrific scenario for what's happening in Africa, the Middle East, and also Asia. You have Islamist insurgencies in Thailand. You've got the conflict between the Buddhists and the Muslims in Burma, Myanmar.
This may well also be a product of the distributed network strategy that they've been using for the last 5 or 6 years. That's something I forget his name. You'll probably know who I'm talking about, Patrick. The Syrian theorist who wrote a very long book that was available on the internet how to set up strategy.
Yeah, Abu Musab al-Suri.
That's right, al-Suri. Yeah. He's his entire thing was not to have a hierarchical system, but just to encourage this stuff universally, all over the map. And this seems to be the result of it.
And Abu Musab al-Suri, his actual name is Mustafa Setmarian.
Doesn't look Arab. He looks like a Westerner.
He's got red hair.
He's redhead. Yeah. That's him.
And he lived in Europe. He operated in Spain. He operated in London for a long time during the 90s.
I did an article for AT about him a while ago, his strategic theories.
Yeah, and he was part of the Al-Qaeda core. He was part of the Shura Council of Al-Qaeda, and he was actually opposed to the 9/11 attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one who, as you were saying, basically instituted this what they call leaderless jihad. His term is system, not organization. You don't need Al-Qaeda core to give you directions. Here's the ideology, here's the targeting, and this is what we see in the AQAP magazines, Inspire. And even the ISIS magazine, English magazine, The Beak, is they say, okay, here's the religious justification. Here's the article on how to build a bomb in your mother's kitchen, which came out of Inspire magazine, and here's your targeting. And you don't need to get permission from us. Go forth
right,
and
take it from there. Sure. And you can't fight this kind of distributed network with the way we're fighting it, with this centralized, World War II mobilization type thing.
Well, you can fight it. I mean, it's just going to take a long time.
It's going to take a long time. You're going to have a lot of failures.
You're fighting counterinsurgencies. We've got to develop reliable partners. which of course we don't have, you know, because, you know, these jihadists are used as proxies for the various policies of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, even the UAE, of course, our friends, the Pakistanis, you know, who were sheltering the Pakistani ISI, who was sheltering Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad, you know, a mile away from, you know, basically the Pakistan
West Point. Yeah.
West Point. So we don't have reliable partners in these regions. We, as I mentioned earlier, our intelligence agencies, in terms of human intelligence, are flying blind. Everything's driven by signals intelligence, but they have so much of it, nobody can analyze it, which was the problem before 9/11. And we see these attacks. You know, talking about the distributed networks, we've seen the two terror attacks in Canada in October that killed two army officials.
The Tsarnaevs, for that matter.
The Tsarnaevs. You had the Sydney hostage situation last month.
Major
in Australia.
Hassan.
Major Hassan. You know, and of course the Paris attacks last week, but as I've been writing at PJ Media, you know, the whole counterterrorism theory of lone wolf was basically to absolve the government and the what I call counterterrorism Inc. You know, all these academics and
right,
counterterrorism people, to basically throw up their hands and say, there's no way that we can predict any of this, so give us more money for us to tell you that. And in every case we just mentioned, these individuals were already known to law enforcement. You know, in the case of the Boston bombing, the FSB warned the FBI not once but twice
right.
about Tamerlane Tsarnaev. You know, in the Fort Hood massacre, the FBI field office in San Diego was watching in real time as Major Hassan was emailing Anwar Awlaki in Yemen, and the FBI headquarters shut that investigation down. You know, and now we're seeing with this Paris attack where you have what looks like an AQAP cell operating. You know, you've got six members out there that they can't find. The one guy's wife who did the kosher deli shooting, Turkish intelligence let his wife slip through the net, and so now she's in Syria. And who only knows? And it is just a matter of time before we see something like Boston, like Fort Hood, here again in the United States, and everybody will be, you know, oh, you know, we couldn't see
this. Flabbergasted. How could this have happened?
I wanted to talk about ISIS or Islamic State. We mentioned them briefly, but they seem to have slowed their momentum a little bit, and probably because the bombings and the air power of the United States has pretty much kept them at bay. They have not taken Kobani. In fact, they've the Kurds have rolled them back a bit. And but elsewhere in Syria, they're still advancing. And of course, Patrick, could you talk a little bit about the alliance between the Al Nusra Front, which is the Al Qaeda offshoot that is very effective at fighting in Syria, and Islamic State, who were actually shooting each other until they made an alliance last summer. What's going on with that, and is that alliance likely to hold?
Well, I'm not quite convinced about the analysis that we've been able to roll back ISIS in Syria and Iraq. ISIS is still making gains in Iraq. They're in control of about 70% of Anbar province. They're right at the gates of Baghdad. They still control about 40%, the last map I saw here on Monday, of Kobani in northern Syria. They're basically rolling up these so-called vetted moderate groups like the Syrian Revolutionaries Front, Harakat al-Hazm, both of which were U.S.-backed and had received missiles last year. They've completely rolled those folks up. We're seeing ISIS fighting north of Damascus now. Jabhat al-Nusra is in control of the area south of Damascus on the Golan, where I reported from here a little over a year ago. When I was on the Golan Heights, I mean, we could literally look over the border and watch multiple skirmishes going on, and I reported that there at PJ Media. And the administration wants to spin that these airstrikes are having an effect. When you read the non-U.S. sources, meaning the reporters who are not contingent upon their White House contacts, the view is quite different, that ISIS really hasn't been too heavily affected. You've got 1,000 people coming over the Turkish-Syrian border to join ISIS every month. We might be killing, at most, maybe a couple hundred a month. I mean, the airstrikes are extremely limited, and they're kind of running with impunity.
Yeah, well, classically, airstrikes can't halt an insurrection of this type. In any case,
right.
you need people to go in and clean it out.
Well, and that's why we're back in.
They're most effective when they are used as a supporting ground troops.
Right, exactly. Look at Vietnam. This is the same strategy.
But outside of that, you're right.
Earlier.
I mean, just going in and attacking a hut where they think some terrorists
think,
are, Yeah, exactly.
It's the same thing when I was a kid that was going on in Vietnam during the early years, 1964 and 1965. They were flying these hyper-advanced supersonic fighters, F-100s, F-105s, all around South Vietnam, blowing up everything in sight and announcing that they defeated the Viet Cong, and they did nothing.
The one thing I wanted to add about our strategy, of course, we're backing the Shiite, Iranian-backed Shiite militias to try and roll them back in Iraq. And we're backing the Kurds, but it's highly unlikely that the Kurds are going to be able to expand beyond what historically is considered their territory.
Kurdistan, yeah.
They're not going to be able, and certainly the Sunnis in Iraq will not tolerate the Kurds moving beyond Mosul or anything like that. And at this point, the Kurds aren't even close.
And what about the Turks? The Turks are going to have a say.
I see some of these D.C. people saying, well, we need to arm the Kurds. And
solution of the week.
I've got a friend who works the Iraq desk at ODNI, and I said, well, what do you think about that? And they said, well, we arm the Kurds, and then they're suddenly going to be massacred by the Turks and the Iranians because they don't want to see an independent Kurdistan. So,
absolutely.
Giving the Kurds a fighting chance to defend themselves and to defend some of the ethnic minorities like the Yazidis, like the Chaldeans and the Assyrians, the Christians. And, of course, the Kurds have massacred those folks, all those groups as well, historically, over the past century. But You know, they're just not going to be able to go beyond their own historical areas. So, you know, what are you going to do with, you know, all these areas in northern Iraq and northern Syria that the Kurds really haven't occupied? I mean, it's I haven't heard a scenario beyond wishful thinking.
Well, that sums up the Obama policy to fight terrorism
for everything.
Well.
For everything.
Yeah. Getting back to ISIS, there are two groups that have differentiated themselves from other terrorist organizations, outfits, militias, if you will. Islamic State and Boko Haram. Both have declared a caliphate. Both appear to be capable of standing up in stand-up fights against trained military, and both seem to be making progress toward whatever their ultimate goal is, which I guess is a worldwide Islamic caliphate. Is there a chance that any other terrorist groups like al-Shabaab, like perhaps one of the insurgencies in Asia, also developing that kind of capability? I mean, is that on the horizon?
Oh, absolutely, yes. You know, we've already got, you know, areas in North Africa that are controlled by Ansar al-Sharia, AQIM, and at some point, Rick, you asked earlier about Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's official affiliate in Syria, and ISIS. You know, I've said in my articles at PJ Media, you know, I anticipate that there's going to be some great reconciliation, you know, some kind of mediation between the two, because that's what's happened historically in these cases, and they're going to make peace. You know, here last this time last year, we had three of Washington, D.C.'s best and brightest say, well, you know, we need to back moderate al-Qaeda in Syria against ISIS. And this was an article published in Foreign Affairs, you know, the preeminent foreign policy journal in the foreign affairs community. And I just had to, you know, roll my eyes when I saw that. I mean, it's that's a snapshot of the absurdity of our foreign policy community. You know, you have this New York DC foreign policy corridor that bears no relation to reality. I mean, you know, these are the same folks who said, oh, well, you know, we need to back the Muslim Brotherhood in all these countries to overthrow our longtime allies, and that will bring peace to the Middle East. Okay, well, we did that, and look at what we got.
Yeah. Just have a few minutes left, Patrick. I wanted to talk about the fact that the clock is ticking. And I've followed several congressional hearings on this, and these terrorism experts have testified that it's only a matter of time before one of these groups gets their hands on a nuclear weapon. I mean, you can look up in the Internet how to build one, basically. And all you need is enriched uranium and a trigger, and that's about it. And a little bit of research and
for
testing.
A gun type bomb is very simple.
Very simple, yes. Very. It's the Hiroshima bomb.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, if you were to hazard a guess, which a terrorist group would be likely to get their hands on a nuclear weapon that they could use against us?
Which one is most closely allied to Iran?
Well, Iran's probably the most likely. You know, people want to focus on Jabhat al-Nusra and ISIS. Well, I mean, Iran and Hezbollah, you know, are
right.
And the Assad was trying to build, you know, he had that nuclear weapons plant, which Israel destroyed here about 2 years ago, leveled to the ground. So, you know, and the more that Iran continues to develop its nuclear program, we're going to see these Shiite states, whether it be Qatar, UAE, of course the Saudis, try and develop their own program.
Sure.
Sunni states.
Another
and of course, you have the Pakistanis who already have. Yeah, I mean, you have the Pakistanis who already have nuclear weapons.
Well, the Saudis can buy one from the Pakistanis.
And I mean,
that's another thing. I don't see these states selling nuclear weapons. That one, it took half their GDP to build the darn thing. I mean, why would Iran sell a nuclear weapon?
Well, Saudis can pay half their
weapon?
GDP for it. That's a problem.
Yeah, but
Saudis are a whole
why
lot
would
richer
Iran
than the
sell a nuclear weapon to a terrorist group like ISIS or whoever? They wouldn't sell to the Islamic State. Why would any of these Muslim countries sell a nuclear weapon to a terrorist group? Not when it's taken so much of their time and energy and effort to build one. You would think they'd want to keep it for themselves. I just don't see the logic in it.
In the case of Iran, it's not that they would sell a weapon; it's that they might use a weapon. If it's Iran who lights off a nuke, there's really not much difference whether it's Iran or a state actor or a non-state actor who does it. I mean, the effect is still the same. And as we see the proliferation in the Middle East of nuclear weapons, which is bound to happen as long as we continue to let Iran develop
right.
their program, the Sunnis are going to respond in kind. It creates the possibility of the nuclear weapons ending up in the hands of rogue actors. I mean, that's the concern we have with Pakistan, is that, you know, if the ISI turns and overthrows the government or the Tariqi Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, overthrow the government, I mean, then suddenly you've got, terror groups with nuclear weapons.
But I would predict before that happens, there would be a nuclear civil war between the Sunnis and Shiites.
Now that could be.
That would be my prediction.
That's possible. JR, I'm going to have to give you the last word on that.
All righty.
We've run out of time. We have run out of time.
Okay, Patrick,
I want to thank our guest. Got to thank our guest first. That's how it's done in radio, you know. Patrick Poole. Terrorism and national security correspondent for PJ Media and prolific writer on the net. You can catch his stuff all over the place. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Patrick, real
pleasure. And J.R. Dunham, editor of American Maker, wonderful to have you on again, J.R. We'll have you on, have you on again real soon. Well, we didn't scream at each other this time, at least.
Well, when did we?
Okay. Well, not screaming at each other.
Really?
We've had our disagreements.
Yeah. Well, terrorism is something I don't think we're going to disagree with. I'll talk to you guys later.
No, I don't think so either. Thanks, JR. And join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.